From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. On the program today, we talk to a Republican member of the FCC about the repeal of net neutrality.
More choices, more competition to consumers, and that's ultimately going to be a great thing for them.
The Consul General of Canada in Detroit says a trade war would hurt both countries.
We are your biggest customer. We buy more from you than China, the UK, and Japan combined.
An adoptee says Michigan's laws discriminate against people who are adopted.
Even though I knew my birth mother, her family, my birth father's family, for nearly three decades, they still refused to give me my birth certificate in 1989.
And illegal immigration is a topic in the Republican race for attorney general nomination.
Liberals are trying to turn Michigan into a sanctuary state, opening our state to legal aliens.
One candidate accuses the other of hiring an undocumented alien. The Truth Squad looks at that. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Coming up, we'll talk to Canada's Consul General in Detroit about what the current trade tensions mean for Michigan. But first, the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, is implementing what it's calling the Restoring Internet Freedom Order. FCC Chair Ajit Pai calls the order a repeal of, quote, unnecessary and harmful internet regulations, end quote. Others call it a repeal of internet neutrality protections. The FCC is repealing the rules implemented by the Obama administration in 2015. The vote was along party lines, with three Republicans voting for the repeal, the two Democrats voting against it. One of the Republicans is Brendan Carr, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
I read the FCC member statements, including yours, for repealing net neutrality, and there was a lot of emphasis about how net neutrality was holding back potential investment to more services. I got the idea, though, that restoring internet freedom was more about the freedom for internet service providers than freedom for people who use the internet. What is the FCC doing to ensure the users of the internet are not going to get gouged with surcharges and tariffs for the exact same services they get now?
Protections are remaining in place. So if an ISP did attempt to block a website or enter into some agreement to anti-competitively discriminate in favor of some content or another content, speeding it up, slowing it down, those things are now going to be violations of Federal Trade Commission law, and the Federal Trade Commission can step in and stop them. So the protections that people expect and understand when we talk about net neutrality principles are going to continue to be there. And in fact, we aren't changing the law at all with respect to the legality of, say, bundled internet offerings or the ability of an ISP to charge more or less for something. The law is not changing with that respect with this particular repeal that we did.
Let's talk about the FTC and its protections, because FTC commissioner told Wired that it only has the authority to pursue individual businesses for unfair and anti-competitive actions. It can't issue industry-wide rules, such as a ban on blocking unlawful content. And in many cases, the agency might be unable to use antitrust laws against broadband providers that give preferential treatment to their own content or that of other partners. So is it really going to be protected by the FTC?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the commissioner that you're referencing was in the minority and so obviously disagreed with some of the decisions that had been made. But no, the Federal Trade Commission actually does have rulemaking authority. They can engage in rulemaking in this space. Second of all, if an ISP, an internet provider, were to engage in any conduct and if the FTC steps in and stops that, then that becomes the law of the land, and it's binding then against all similarly situated ISPs. So it won't be a game of whack-a-mole where you have to individually find and take action. Consumers are going to be protected across the board on this.
So let me ask you just point blank, who's going to keep an eye on internet providers to make sure consumers don't end up getting charged more money for, well, for instance, when I'm streaming Netflix? Will Netflix charge me more so they have the access so my Netflix doesn't stop in the middle of the video? What happens here?
Yeah, I mean, look, consumers want better, faster, cheaper broadband. They don't want their rates going up or to have to charge more. And a couple points on that. One, the 2015 Title II regime actually did not impose any restrictions on that conduct in terms of rate regulation. So by repealing that 2015 decision, we aren't changing the law at all with respect to that. So consumers aren't going to see a difference in that respect. But second of all, if we do see conduct that starts to move in that direction, the Federal Trade Commission, which again is our nation's premier consumer protection agency, these are the experts at identifying consumer harm and addressing it, are now the cop on the beat. In 2015, with that Title II regulation, as I indicated, they were stripped of their jurisdiction to take any action against ISPs. So now consumers have the protection and the backing of the Federal Trade Commission.
A number of states, I think 20 states, have filed suit trying to stop the repeal of net neutrality. A CNN Money article reports that that in the order, this new order, the FCC asserts authority to prevent states from pursuing laws inconsistent with net neutrality repeal. Why is that necessary?
So we made a federal decision about the classification of broadband, and just a natural operation of federal law means if there's a state that acts inconsistent with it, it's preempted. That's the same point that the commission made in their 2015 decision. But from my perspective, I don't think there's a lot of controversy about the specific rules themselves. So look, if Congress, for instance, wants to step in and adopt a standalone net neutrality bill, no blocking, no throttling, no broken promises, I support that action as well. Again, the controversy is not the rules themselves. It was about that Title II framework that the FCC used to try to get to that result of the rules.
Well, there were millions of people who tried to get a hold of the FCC to disagree with you. What did you think of that response?
I thought it was wonderful. Look, I think people are engaged on this issue. It's an important issue, and people are passionate about it. They should be participating. They should be telling us what their views on it. And we took all those views into account in our decision making. And consumers going forward are going to be protected. Again, this isn't some sort of radical new experiment. We're going back to the same regime that applied during the first 6 years of the Obama administration, this Title I approach to the internet. And consumers are going to continue to be protected. And in fact, what we're expecting based on our record is we're going to see more broadband deployment and more investment. That's going to give more choices, more competition to consumers, and that's ultimately going to be a great thing for them.
So I know there's a lot of concern about access to the internet in rural areas. There's also a lot of concern about access to broadband in small towns and even some suburban areas. So who's actually going to benefit the most from this rule change?
I think consumers are going to benefit the most. I was in Michigan a couple weeks ago, small town Moline, Michigan, farming community. I think a lot of places like that are going to benefit from this. What we were seeing is that the largest broadband providers in the country, the AT&Ts and the Verizons, look, they've got armies of regulatory lawyers that could work through that Title II statutory regime. But there's thousands of smaller mom-and-pop providers. Those are the ones that are out there serving rural America, and they were the ones telling us they didn't have the army of regulatory lawyers to figure out this Title II regime and all the filing and other regulatory requirements. So by eliminating Title II and going back to Title I, that lowers the barriers to entry, and so we're going to see more competition to Verizon, more competition to Comcast, and I'm excited about that.
And who's going to be hurt by this rule? There's always winners and losers.
Yeah, I don't know. So look, at the end of the day, I think a lot of the concern about this decision is about fear that something radically different is going to happen with the consumer experience on the internet. That's simply not the case. I just remind people to think back to that 2015 and the prior 20 years. Consumers were protected. Small businesses grew from garage-based offerings to worldwide behemoths. This is the environment. It's not an experiment that we know is going to fully protect consumers. And it's going to protect businesses as well. So I think it just is fixing a two-year detour, a two-year experiment with heavy-handed regulation that wasn't working.
Brendan Carr is the commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission at the FCC. He voted to repeal net neutrality, and that is implemented this week. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
One of the hot-button issues among conservatives is immigration. In Michigan, a Republican running for attorney general is accusing her opponent of hiring an undocumented immigrant who supports sanctuary cities. Bridge Magazine's Truth Squad looked into that statement. Here's an example of what Republican candidates are saying. This video comes from Senator Tanya Shoemaker.
Liberals are trying to turn Michigan into a sanctuary state, opening our state to legal aliens, letting criminals off the hook. It's crazy. We need to stop them.
Shoemaker goes on to say if she's attorney general in Michigan, she'll ban sanctuary cities and put dangerous criminals in jail.
Say no to sanctuary cities in Michigan. Stand with me to protect our families and our communities.
When Shoemaker read in the Lansing State Journal that what she calls an undocumented immigrant worked in her opponent's office, Representative Tom Leonard, she posted it online. It's the very first thing you see on her campaign website.
All it takes, I guess, from her perception is to say, look, he had this person in his office who's undocumented. What does that say about his qualifications to be attorney general? Is he really solid on this issue?
That's Ted Roloffs with the Truth Squad. Roloffs tracked down the woman who worked in Leonard's office.
Viviana Alamillo is her name. I had an interview with her, and she told me she's just looking for experience. Perhaps she might be interested in politics and working as a staff person someday. So she approached Leonard's office and said she was interested in working as an unpaid intern doing essentially constituent work.
Both Alamillo and Leonard's office say her DACA status was never discussed. At age 3, Alamillo was brought into the U.S. illegally. She qualified for DACA later, and that makes calling her an undocumented immigrant misleading.
This person qualified under DACA in 2012. That was the year that President Obama extended that by executive order. And that means that literally she acquired documents such as a driver's license, such as a Social Security card, and such as a work permit, which allows her to legally work in this country.
Roloffs also looked into the other claim that, quote, the same individual worked as a liberal community organizer promoting sanctuary cities.
This individual, Viviana Alamillo, did confirm to me that she did some kind of volunteer organizing work for the organization, one of the organizations in Lansing that was pushing to have that city declared a sanctuary city. So, yes, that part of the statement is true.
Roloffs noted this might not cause as much outrage among the general public, but it's red meat for the conservative base that both Shoemaker and Leonard want to attract.
The audience for this is really the 2,000 or so delegates that make up the nominating convention for the party. It's a small group you're looking at, probably more conservative than the party broadly, and I guess it remains to be seen whether this sort of attack would register with that group.
The Truth Squad ruled the statement was mostly inaccurate. Saying that Alamillo was undocumented when she volunteered for Leonard is not strictly true, and that she has temporary right to remain in the U.S. The Truth Squad also notes there's nothing in his record that would suggest Tom Leonard has wavered in his hardline approach to immigration. The two Republican candidates for attorney general stand apart from the Democrat running for the position. Dana Nessel is an outspoken supporter of immigrant rights. I'm Lester Graham. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Well, it's time to check in on West Michigan's music scene. As always, our guide is journalist and music critic John Sinkovich, editor and publisher of LocalSpins.com. John, I got to tell you, I had a chance to listen to each of the bands you're going to talk about today. It was a nice way to start the day. So let's start with a musician you say is not new, but is new to West Michigan.
Yes, talk about an unusual and impressive musical background. So singer Daisha Bridges isn't a new artist, but she's new to West Michigan's music scene. She moved to Kalamazoo last year, performing for many years in Germany, where she was a star. Interestingly enough, she not only started it and was a leader of a heavy metal band, but she collaborated with people like Lemmy Kilmister of Motorhead, and she was also a chart topping dance music artist. She released an all-acoustic album, and she eventually moved back to the United States and then moved to Kalamazoo last year, and she started this all-star group, sort of a super group of Michigan musicians, including percussionist Carolyn Keeble. She's in Andro, which is a very well-known Celtic and world music group. Corey Summers of Red Sea Pedestrians and Sarah First of Corn-Fed Girls and Thunderbolt and Lightfoot. Oh, and Bridges is also a dancer, model, and actress, by the way. The Daisha Bridges Project performs June 30 at Old Dog Tavern in Kalamazoo as part of the first Local Spins West Michigan Showcase. And she's also performing June 16th at the Buttermilk Jamboree with the band. Buttermilk Jamboree, for those that might not know, is a very fast up-and-coming music festival. It takes place between Kalamazoo and Grand Rapids, the middle of June every year. Donna the Buffalo is headlining, and a lot of local and regional acts. But Dasha is definitely one of those artists who's definitely somebody to look out for, because she really has a lot of background and experience.
Well, let's take a listen to something from Dasha. This is the Dasha Bridges Project.
Quiet, talking about what you can do, just do it right now. Somehow you will find a way, only you can get you through it. Don't think about it, what they got, 'cause someone else ain't you. Just keep on stepping down your own path. It may be hard to get a grip, but I know that you can do it. Hey, yeah, you are wonderful, and you're beautiful, and don't let nobody tell you wrong, because I know I have been there before, and I know what it's like when you have no strength to carry on. So hey now.
John, I was looking online for some of Dasha's stuff, and I found a German TV show that actually was profiling her band at that time, so I get what you mean, she was a star in Germany. Let's turn to another kind of music right now. We've heard lots of folk music, folk rock music from West Michigan in recent years, but there's another subgenre that's building a devoted fan base here. It's psychedelic rock or psych rock. The next two bands are part of that. So tell us about the first one, the band Susie's.
Yeah, Susie's is a psych-hued Grand Rapids band. Their name was actually inspired by Susie and the Banshees, for those that might remember that band from way back when. It was formed a few years ago, kind of a noisy and chaotic sort of outfit, and they've since gotten a little more melodic, a little more direction with their music, and they would say prettier than it was before. You got a guitarist, singer Luke Bonchick, drummer Casey Heisinger, guitarist Shane Tripp, who also does his own projects, bassist Andrew Tamlin, who used to be in the band Heaters, and keyboard player Adam Niemera, and they recorded their last two albums at the All Analog Studio here in Grand Rapids called Goon Lagoon, which I think really enhances their groovy psychedelic sound. Really sounds retro in a lot of ways, and they were influenced by bands like Jesus and Mary Chain, Spaceman 3, Cosmonauts. They released their most recent album, Forget Me Not, earlier this year on Dizzy Bird Records, and they're already hard at work on their follow-up.
Let's take a listen to something from the Susies. That was the Kids Bop from the Susies. What else do you have for us?
Yeah, so Lazy Genius is another psychedelic rock band. They take a little bit different tack with their music than Susie's, but its sonic approach has evolved over the years as well. The name was Lazy Genius to begin with. They had to sort of use real Lazy Genius for a lot of their bookings because there was another band by the name of Lazy Genius around. But they're really known around here as Lazy Genius, and guitarist Patrick Wieland has fronted this project for all of this time. And it's now expanded to a 6-member band, which really expands its sound. Very enveloping music. When you go to their shows, it sort of surrounds you with music. You got Wieland, you got Daniel Francis, Johnny Bruja, Adam Cavanaugh, Christy Prindle, and John Harrell are all part of the band. They describe their music on their latest EP called New Moon as catchy but unique. It sort of puts together melody with heavy dynamics and an epic structure, and it's gotten quite a bit of attention. The band recently was chosen to open for the B-52s at Meyer Gardens. They'll be performing here in Grand Rapids on July 6th at Creston Brewery.
Let's take a listen to the track Love from their album New Moon.
Love is old. Burns, it stings.
find details and concert updates on all three of these artists on their Facebook pages. And you can learn more about these and other artists with West Michigan roots by going to localspins.com, which is edited and published by John Sinkovich. As always, John, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Support for arts and cultural coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Summer seems like a great time to learn something new about the Great Lakes. So this summer, we want your input. What do you want to know about their history, culture, economy, environment, or anything else about the Great Lakes? Send us your question by going to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org or ask your question in a voicemail. Here's the number, 734-764-7840. Again, that phone number is 734-764-7840. You just might hear the answer on Stateside. A new study finds among birds tested in southwest Michigan, there are many more blood parasites than thought found in birds infected with malaria. The study was published in the Parasitology Research. To understand what that means for birds in Michigan, co-author Martin von Hoff is at Western Michigan University's Institute of the Environment and Sustainability. He joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, Lester.
I'm going to ask you to walk us through this a bit. First, avian malaria. How common is that among songbirds in Michigan?
It's very common, actually. Malaria parasites are distributed worldwide, very commonly found in most mammals, birds, and reptiles. So birds here in Michigan are like birds everywhere else, and they suffer from all kinds of parasitism by all kinds of little creatures.
So what does it mean that there's greater diversity in blood parasites in those birds with avian malaria?
I think what our study shows is that the diversity of parasites that is out there is much larger than we had anticipated. Avian malaria has been studied in Europe and North America for decades. And in our study, we went out expecting to capture a lot of kind of previously described diversity. And instead, what we found was that the majority, almost 60% of the parasite lineages that we observed in the birds hadn't been previously described.
How many parasites are we talking about that you found among the birds you caught?
Yeah, so in total, we found 71 different lineages of parasites, and 42 of those were newly described.
Wow. So what's the impact on songbirds?
Well, so parasites have a multitude of possible effects on their hosts. It's been shown in other studies that avian malaria causes sickness, and of course we know this from human malaria as well. And that sickness then, those physiological effects on the host then, have lots of downstream influences on the reproductive success of these birds, their behavior, and through changes in those individuals who are infected, of course, then there are downstream population level and even community level effects of that parasitism.
Now, we're talking songbirds. That's a pretty broad description. Well, we know some of these kinds of birds. Are they something we might see in our backyard?
Absolutely. The 11 most common bird species that we encountered during our study, which were found across gradients of urbanization here in southwest Michigan, are all birds that many of us will see when we go out in our backyard. So think here of American robins, northern cardinals, black-capped chickadees, white-breasted nuthatches. These are many of my own favorite birds when I go outside in my own house.
So these birds are at some greater risk than we thought. Are humans at increased risk because of these more parasites than you expected?
Absolutely not. And in fact, I'm not even sure that we can say that birds are at greater risk than we thought. I think what our study shows is that really people haven't looked at the diversity that's out there. And so here, during our study, we went out into southwest Michigan and we spent a lot of effort capturing birds at a large number of sites in a relatively defined area. we discovered a lot of this previously undescribed genetic diversity among these parasites. And I think that's meaningful in its own right. It doesn't mean that all of a sudden malaria is emerging in these birds, that we humans should be worried in some way. It just means that there's a set of interactions going on there that are really important to the lives of these animals that we were previously unaware of.
So let me clear this up a little bit, because I know if first we got to deal with humans, then we got to deal with, could this mean a problem for chickens or turkeys or other domestic fowl?
Yeah, so the malaria that infects birds, the set of parasites that we call malaria, doesn't infect mammals at all. So the lineages of parasites that we find in birds are completely different from the lineages that we find in mammals. And it may be that we get bitten by the same insect vector of those parasites. So malaria is transmitted by mosquitoes or biting midges. And it's very possible that the same mosquito might bite into a mammal or a bird first and then bite into the opposite afterwards. And the parasite may even make it into the body of that new host, but it's not going to get very far. It just doesn't have the necessary set of adaptations to be able to survive in that very different host.
And the birds we raise, like chickens, turkeys, domestic fowl of that kind?
So the birds we raise are very distinct from songbirds. And so, you know, chickens and ducks and geese all absolutely are susceptible to particular lineages of avian malaria. It's just that they're very different lineages from the ones that infect songbirds.
The lead author of this study, Jamie Smith, looked at birds in more urban areas. What was found there?
Yeah, so Jamie's study was actually focused on understanding how the risk of parasitism by avian malaria changes across rural to urban gradients. So really trying to understand how urbanization might influence this really important interaction in the lives of these birds. What we know about urbanization is that it tends to remove wetlands. Through this process of development, we tend to kind of decrease the amount of water that's available. And in so doing, then, we're likely decreasing the populations of the insects that might carry these malaria parasites. And so we randomly selected sites all across southwest Michigan that represented this rural to urban gradient, and then we went out and sampled birds across that gradient. And what she's found, actually, is that our prediction is supported by the data, that urban birds suffer lower rates of parasitism than do rural birds. And in fact, the diversity of parasites is also much lower in urban areas than it is in rural areas.
One of the issues that has so much of an impact on what's happening with wildlife today is climate change. Will climate change have any impact on these songbirds?
Yeah, you know, climate change is going to affect everything. The change in climate over time leads to changes in habitat, leads to changes in appropriate timing of reproduction, leads to changes in the relative abundances of a variety of different kinds of organisms. And of course, we can't just focus in on one part of an ecosystem, one part of nature that we might be interested in, because of course, many of the organisms interact with one another. And so this process of climate change then leads to changes in how organisms interact with one another. And that will influence every organism on this planet. As communities change, as ecosystems change, the relative abundances of the organisms in those ecosystems will change. And of course, then those interactions that they're involved in, such as predation, competition, and parasitism, like we studied, will also change. And so our research is really trying to understand, well, how is it changing? And what does this mean for the lives of organisms in these changing environments?
I want to go back to the very fact of your findings, and that's there's this greater diversity of blood parasites. How surprised were your colleagues across your research field to this finding? Why hasn't it been looked at before?
I think the honest answer is that anybody who studies a group of organisms that isn't a vertebrate knows that they tend to be understudied and that there's a lot of diversity out there that we just don't pay attention to. So all the small things in this world, the malaria parasites, the mites, the nematode worms, the bacteria, are very understudied relative to bigger things that we like to focus our attention on. people who study avian malaria constantly find new lineages when they look. It was a surprise, I think, that we could find such a high level of undiscovered diversity in an area that is fairly well sampled and has been sampled for a long time. People have been studying avian malaria here in the United States and the upper Midwest for decades, if not centuries. And yet, you know, in a period of two summers, you know, we could go out and 60% of the lineages that we found hadn't been previously described. And I do think that's really noteworthy.
Are you getting naming rights? Is there going to be some kind of Von Hoff parasite or a Smith parasite now? Or?
You always have to ask yourself, do I really want my name associated with a parasite? we're definitely not there yet. You know, the way we describe the diversity of malaria parasites is through the use of a particular gene. And you may have noticed that I use the term lineage diversity. And so this is really about what's happening in this one gene. But of course, we need much more information than the sequence that we get from one particular gene to name a new species. And in general, then, we collect information based on this gene that tells us that something may be going on, and then it's up to, you know, us or others to really figure out, are these lineages representative of new species?
Martin Von Hoff is a biologist at the Institute of Environment and Sustainability at Western Michigan University. He's co-author of a new study which documented greater diversity of blood parasites infecting songbirds with avian malaria. Thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Still to come, imagine what it would be like if obtaining your own birth certificate was against the law. A new memoir reveals that's just one of the many bureaucratic hurdles adoptees face to learning basic information about themselves. We'll hear that story in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Things got worse for trade between the U.S. and Canada this weekend. Canada's Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, announced retaliatory tariffs equal to the tariffs the U.S. placed on steel and aluminum. President Trump is taking it personally. He feels betrayed by Trudeau. Trump tweeted insults regarding the Prime Minister. Trump aides on Sunday morning news shows called Trudeau a backstabber who deserved a special place in hell. Joining us now is the Consul General of Canada in Detroit, Douglas George. I want to note you're also recognized as a trade expert, so I'm hoping you can help us clear up what this might mean for Michigan and the U.S. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
First, some basics. Canada is the United States' biggest trade partner. On July 1, what kind of impact will there be in the U.S. because of these retaliatory tariffs?
Yeah, as you said, Canada is the U.S.'s biggest partner. We are your biggest customer. We buy more from you than China, the UK, and Japan combined. And we do a very healthy trade in steel and aluminum. In fact, Canada buys more steel from the US than we sell to the US. There's a $2 billion trade surplus. So when the US administration decided to impose tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum, our position is that this is totally unacceptable. The U.S. is using a national security argument to justify its imposition of tariffs, but we think it is entirely inappropriate to view any trade with Canada as a national security threat to the U.S. In response to the measures, we intend to impose tariffs on imports of steel, aluminum, and certain other products from the U.S. As you said, we are imposing dollar-for-dollar tariffs for every dollar levied against Canadians by the U.S. It's a fair and proportional response.
Is this raw steel, raw aluminum, or are we talking about parts that travel back and forth between the countries for assembly of vehicles on both sides of the border?
Well, where we are putting our tariffs, our countermeasures, are things like flat-rolled products, tubes and pipes, bars and rods, the basic steel products. But if you put tariffs on basic steel, it raises the cost of steel to producers of parts and other products, and ultimately it will raise the cost of an automobile, which would use a lot of steel and aluminum. And Canada's view is that tariffs of this sort are completely opposite to the approach we prefer to take. It's going to hurt both sides. U.S. tariffs are going to hurt Canadians, but they're also going to hurt U.S. workers.
President Trump said he would look at tariffs on automobiles flooding the U.S. market, but Japanese, Korean, and German manufacturers all have plants in the U.S. employing American workers. In fact, I read recently that the vehicle with the most American parts was a Toyota Camry. How would tariffs affect these foreign-owned companies making cars in the U.S. to whom Canada provides parts as well?
Well, what we're talking about is tariffs on steel and aluminum crossing the border. So whether it goes into a Japanese-badged vehicle or a Detroit 3-badged vehicle, it's going to have the same effect. If you look at the trade between Canada and the U.S., there are auto parts that can cross the border 6 or 7 times before being incorporated into the final vehicle. And we don't compete against each other on building autos. We cooperate with each other. Canada and the U.S. build things together. We have companies on both sides. We trade back and forth. This is more productive, more efficient for both of us.
What's the thinking within the Canadian government as to avoiding an all-out trade war between the countries?
Our preference is, of course, to avoid a trade war because it hurts everyone. But equally, Canada will defend Canadian interests, and we will respond proportionately, as we have done on these steel and aluminum tariffs. But ultimately, we think the best approach is to renegotiate NAFTA. This is what President Trump has proposed. We've been fully engaged. We've come up with ideas. NAFTA is an old agreement. It's been around for 24 years, and as I like to say, when we negotiated it and you said the word Amazon, people would think of a large river somewhere in South America, whereas now Amazon is the biggest company in the world. It is just out of date in a number of areas. NAFTA is still there, and it still remains in force, but we would like to renegotiate and update it so it not only is dealing with jobs now, but jobs into the future.
What impact is this trade tension having on the Gordie Howe Bridge plans?
I've seen no effect on the Gordie Howe Bridge plans. Canada remains fully committed to building this bridge. Windsor-Detroit Bridge Authority, the WDBA, has received the bids and is assessing them, and will be deciding on the preferred proponent in the coming weeks.
I understand the bids, for the most part, were over what was expected.
I'm not authorized to talk about what's in the bids, but there's aspects that the WDBA will be working with the bidders on, and ultimately we will choose a preferred partner and move ahead with building this bridge, which is vital to the economy of Michigan and Ontario. I like to remind people the bridge runs both ways. Canada is financing the bridge because it's important to us, but it's also important to you to have the increased efficiency, increased predictability, and increased security of having a new 6-lane bridge on the Detroit River.
How do Canadians view President Trump's strategy and his attempt to balance trade with the rest of the world?
Well, to some extent, there's a little bit of confusion when he talks about Canada because the U.S. runs a trade surplus with Canada, and our economists say that that deficit or surplus isn't the correct way of approaching it. But Canada and the U.S. enjoy fair and balanced trade. We have for a very long time. We're the USA's closest friend, partner, and ally, and we're going to keep working to make sure this relationship works to the benefit of both of us.
Douglas George is the Consul General of Canada in Detroit. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you very much, Lester.
You don't know how lucky you are. That's the title of a book by a Michigan man who's been fighting the system that hid his birth records. Why? Because he's an adoptee. Rudy Owens joins us. I should give the entire book title, which is You Don't Know How Lucky You Are, An Adoptee's Journey Through the American Adoption Experience. Why did you write this memoir?
Well, I think it's important for Americans to understand the adoptee experience. We number about 5 million people in the United States. And then when you think of that, there's at least 5 million birth mothers. And everyone has siblings who might have adoptee relatives or know someone who's adopted someone. So we are a large part of this country whose stories mainly remain hidden in the shadow. What I wanted to do is remove the stigma associated with the adoptee experience and help people understand why adoptees today in the year 2018 are fighting screen at least to get access to their identity records so they can know who they are. It's an important story. It's a civil rights story. It's an equal rights story. I think it's time that story get told openly and honestly.
I would think knowing something about your biological past and your health traits might be important too.
Oh, it's absolutely critical. Nearly every medical expert, the Surgeon General and other major medical organizations always recommend knowing your family medical history. Think about the BRCA gene for women who may have a probability of cancer. There are adoptee women who may never know they have a higher risk of cancer just because they may be born in some state where they can't get those records. So if we do believe in promoting population health and human health and individual health, it seems to make sense that we would want to ensure that everyone can get their family background.
Let's talk about Michigan. You call Michigan's adoption record law outdated and discriminatory. In what ways?
Well, when I say discriminatory, I basically mean there is a law and it applies to people two different ways. There are people who are adopted and people who are not adopted. When people who are not adopted want to know what their vital records are, including their birth certificate, they fill out a form, they're treated professionally. They pay a fee, they get their document. When someone who is adopted wants to know where they come from, they hit what we call a brick wall, where they hit all kinds of barriers based on their year of birth. And it almost is impossible because of the system to even know what your family origins are or to even get access to your records. There are also two tiers of adoptees in Michigan. I was born in the tier between 1945 and 1980, where I actually have a higher threshold to basically, I have to get a court order to get my birth certificate.
Now, wait, if you were born before 45, it's a different set of rules. If you were born after 1980, it's a different set of rules.
That is correct. And I can't tell you the rationale among the lawmakers who did it that way, but we know from the data that these are the boom years of American adoption. There were nearly 3 million adoptions between the years 1945 and 1975. That's when it was the system that promoted it. That's when we had the national system that promoted that as the choice for single mothers.
What is the reason the state, the government, gives you for being so secretive about your personal records?
Well, what I usually hear from the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services is it's the law. I don't hear anything more beyond that. What I just hear is that is the law, and we are here to enforce the law, and you have to abide by the rules. In my case, I had found my birth mother in 1989. I had her sign a consent form that basically stated Michigan could release my birth records to me. Even though I knew my birth mother, her family, my birth father's family, for nearly three decades, they still refused to give me my birth certificate in 1989. In 2016, I asked again. They still refused to give it to me, even though I had a family record of knowing each other. And they made me get a court order, which I got, and finally got my birth certificate.
That's a lot of process. You've got some suggestions for the state of Michigan. Let's go through them.
Right.
First, you say the state should do a better job in providing accurate data on adoptees born here.
Yeah.
That's not done?
No, that is a national problem. The counting of adoptees was always voluntary. We had a system that counted adoptees, again, in those big boom years from 1945 to 75. That was voluntary. So what we have is an estimate, a pretty good estimate between those years, that there were nearly 3 million adoptees. Since that time, there has been no official counting of them. The U.S. Census has only been counting them since the year 2000 and then in 2010. And even then, it's not counting adoptees who are adults. So we have this large group of people who were born as adoptees. And I think it's important to have data because when you are counted, you count. And when you count, people pay attention. So Michigan, like other states, can say, well, we don't need to help these people or provide them access because we don't know who they are or how many there are. If we had a better estimate that there was a huge number of Michiganders who are denied some information that others get by law, then people might pay attention to that.
Second, you suggest Michigan should track all requests for birth records by adoptees. How does that help?
Well, I think what we don't know is how many people are asking for help. So what the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services told me when I asked for an interview and then they replied by email is that they're not counting how many requests are coming in. So we don't know how many people are asking for help. What we do know is just some data that they're saying about how much information is released. And again, when you're releasing information, it's only after you've cleared these enormous hurdles, one, that you've miraculously, by luck and by grit, found out what your parents were. In Michigan, birth parents have the ability to redact information if they want through the system. So you, first of all, you've got to find your birth mother. Then you've got to get that person to hopefully sign a consent form.
If she's still living.
If they're around, right. And they could be somewhere else. So it's very difficult. So what would be really helpful, I think, for lawmakers and for everyone else is just to know what the volume is of people coming in, and then we can know what the success rate is or the failure rate. And again, if we find that there's some disparities, maybe we can address those disparities. I think this is pretty much bipartisan in nature. It's just good government. Government agencies, particularly dedicated to health and human services, are great at tracking data. Why can't we track this a little better?
You point to the Central Adoption Registry,
yeah,
and you call for a performance audit of that office.
Yep.
Why?
Well, it's unusual that because I have written about adoption, people are contacting me around the country who were born. I had a woman contact me in Scotland. I have people contacting me who have some long-term illnesses and others. They say they're born here, but they can't get any help when they try to get help. And the only place you can get help is this office. This is the office that handles requests that come in. They come in from the court. They come in from an adoption agency. They process. They determine whether or not there is information on file that indicates whether a birth parent would release information or not. And if so, then they could possibly release information. But that office isn't there to help an adoptee. If you call, you're not going to talk to anyone. They may call you back. There's no email that you can ask. I born in this circumstance. Here's my question. What can I do? I, in my circumstance, had a situation that I do not believe was covered by law because I had found my birth parents, and theoretically, common sense should dictate my birth certificate should have been given. But she basically said, and it was a one-person office from what I understand, fill out the dang form. And that doesn't seem to me really good customer service when we basically hope government is there to serve the people that put them there.
Finally, you call for the state to provide more staff to answer adoptee questions like you were talking about. How's that going to help everyone?
Well, I think people don't understand what it's like to be an adoptee asking for help. When you go into the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services building in Lansing, which I was this week when I went to visit lawmakers, they stand behind a sealed glass office with a very thick window, and they stand in a very defensive posture. And I actually proposed to them some of these ideas, and they weren't very interested in talking to me. So what I suggested to them and to some state lawmakers who had the benefit of meeting and their staff was what we can do is perhaps free up some staff time, make sure that the staff can at least take questions. You can log questions during the day. You can get an answering machine. You can set up an email where people could send questions in a reasonable amount of time. People can answer those questions in a professional and courteous manner. It's not that way right now with the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, and that's just unfortunate.
Now, when I was looking at your blog, you did send in some questions, and you didn't get all of them answered. You didn't even get half of them answered.
No, I did not.
But you did get answers.
I got some answers.
So it's not completely broken, it sounds like.
No, and those answers, what I was trying to do was just to determine, you know, in my case, like, how did you come to a decision to deny me my birth certificate when all this information was available, when common sense would have dictated it should have been released? And I also wanted information how they were working. So you have to basically go through a reporter-like process, submit questions, and then get an answer. They would not allow anyone who was in the decision-making process to ever talk to me. I thought that was unfortunate since they were the ones making determinations about a document that took me 51 years to get.
And we want to talk about that in just a second, but let's talk about the lawmakers. How did those conversations go? How receptive were they?
Well, I'm going to applaud the Michigan State Legislature staff. Everyone was professional and courteous across the aisle. I talked to Republicans. I talked to Democrats. Their staff were always there to listen. I let them know who I was, why I had flown across the country. I told them about my book. I told them about my experience, and then I told them about simple ways we can make some solutions that don't cost a lot of money and help the residents. Everyone likes something that isn't too confrontational. So I got good treatment. What I heard was from two staff members of at least two lawmakers that their husbands were adopted and had gone through similar experiences. I know one member of the Michigan Senate is an adoptee. I ran into people because I was wearing a t-shirt that said adoptee rights are human rights, have conversations with me. A woman hugged me because she had gone through the exact same experience as me. I ran into a man at my hotel whose sister had given up her child for adoption when she was 17. So people want to talk about it. It gets it out of the shadows. So I think that they like it, but right now it's not on anyone's agenda. There's a lot on the agenda in Lansing right now, and this is not there.
You ultimately did receive a copy of your original birth certificate after the state had refused to hand it over. What changed?
Well, what changed was they had to comply with the law. In this case, they said, go to the court and get a court order. We're not going to talk to you anymore. And I said, okay. That is not an easy process. Going to a court is a very difficult thing. They don't provide any information online how to do that because it's going to be different in different counties. I had to piece it together talking to staff at the juvenile court in Wayne County, and I had to fill out three different forms, and then I had a seven-minute hearing with a judge, Judge Dingell, and Judge Dingell ruled in my favor mainly because I had known my birth family, and at the end of our seven-minute hearing on the telephone, he said, I am supposed to find just cause for allowing this person to have his birth certificate, and no one has told me what just cause means, and he's very frustrated with the experience too because the legislature isn't telling him how to determine what just cause is to release this document that many adoptees would like without this hassle.
Rudy Owens wrote the book, You Don't Know How Lucky You Are, An Adoptee's Journey Through the American Adoption Experience. Thanks for telling us about this problem that most of us weren't aware of.
Great to be here. Thank you so much.
Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Bob Scon. Today's Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and April Van Buren. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.